It may not be perfect compromise. It's the only compromise that's on the table.
Governor Bill Walker tells lawmakers if they don't like his budget ideas, they should come up with their own. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, 14 hours in a crevasse on Denali.
With a pneumatic chisel, they were able to free him from the ice.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in training programs from office administration to water and wastewater treatment. Tweet hashtag CareersBeginHere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
Governor Bill Walker told lawmakers opposed to his compromise proposal to resolve the state's budget crisis that they should produce their own compromise ideas.
It may not be a perfect compromise. It's the only compromise that's on the table. I would welcome other compromises coming forth. I submitted a compromise because I didn't see one.
Walker supports a Senate proposal to draw money from the permanent fund earnings to pay for state government. He also backs the Senate plan to cut permanent fund dividends to $1,000, and he backs a Senate bill to overhaul oil and gas tax credits. But Walker endorses the House plan for the budget. He also supports a so-called head tax that would require workers in Alaska to pay one of five tax amounts based on their income. House majority leaders criticized the package, especially since it contains a deficit they say that could lead to future cuts to school and other spending. The Senate majority caucuses met this afternoon to discuss the plan. A state government shutdown will begin on July 1st if lawmakers don't reach a compromise. Walker says the effect will be widespread.
Registration of cars, selling houses, marriage certificate, death certificates, I mean, all sorts of things that we take for granted. I mean, I think we don't realize sometimes all we take for granted until suddenly we look at those services not going to be available. Commercial fishing would be significantly impacted, no question about that.
Administration officials say details of a potential government shutdown will be available later this week. President Donald Trump announced this week he wants to privatize the FAA's air traffic control operations, in part to speed up modernization.
We're still stuck with an ancient, broken, antiquated, horrible system that doesn't work.
Trump focused on airline service. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin asks what privatizing might mean for general aviation.
Trump is endorsing a decades-old idea, spearheaded these days by House Transportation Chairman Bill Schuster. The idea is to shift air traffic control away from the FAA into a nonprofit corporation, supported by fees. Advocates say a corporation is more agile and better suited to complete the switch to modern technology. Most major airlines are on board. But among small airplane owners and the general aviation industry, skepticism abounds.
We need to do things different. There's no argument there. I'm just a little concerned that general aviation is going to be boxed out of the decision-making process.
Adam White, government liaison for the Alaska Airmen Association, says the U.S. has an excellent air traffic control system that is modernizing, but slowly. White says some of the delay may be good.
Not something that you can implement, and if it doesn't work, we can come back 6 months later and look at it. It's got to work, or people are going to die.
Many non-airline aviators worry about the user fees the self-financed corporation is expected to impose. White wonders if fees might extend to pre-flight weather briefings and other vital services.
Our concern is that if folks have to pay to be able to do that, they're not going to avail themselves as freely to those services as they do today. And that's going to result in some safety concerns.
General aviation now pays at the pump through a fuel tax of about 20 cents per gallon. Under several Republican plans, the board controlling air traffic operations would have seats for various stakeholders, like the airlines, the pilots' union, and recreational pilots. Still, people in general aviation say their voices could be drowned out. Mark Baker is the president of the Airplane Owners and Pilots Association, which has 300,000 members, 3,000 in Alaska.
We don't register any complaints about the current system.
Baker says the reports he sees show most airline delays are due to weather and problems other than traffic control. Among the satisfied general aviators is Joe Brown, who runs an Ohio-based propeller company.
When I fly, I find a modern system, a high-functioning system.
Brown testified against privatization last month at a House hearing. He paints a far different picture from the antiquated control technology the president spoke of.
I can file a flight plan from my smartphone and get my proposed route back before I get to the airport in a text. When I take off, I have GPS navigation systems on board that allow me to fly point to point all over this country.
Brown says he's happy that enhanced technology guides him on precision approaches at hundreds of airports. About 40 of them are in Alaska. Alaska Congressman Don Young said at last month's hearing, the privatization initiative seems to be trying to reform the best part of the FAA. Though he's not necessarily opposed.
As long as Alaska is taking care of their need for general aviation and not being run by the larger airlines, I'll be somewhat interested in what we're doing.
One of the arguments for privatization is it would allow a steady funding source removed from the budget uncertainties of Congress. President Trump signed a memo and a letter outlining his privatization plans Monday at a White House ceremony. It looked like a bill signing, but the documents have no legal impact. The plan still has substantial opposition in Congress. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A Denali climber was rescued yesterday after spending 14 hours deeply wedged inside a crevasse. National Park Service spokeswoman Marine Galtieri reports 38-year-old Martin Takak of Slovakia fell unroped into the crevasse while descending the peak before 1:30 a.m. on Monday.
Mr. Takak fell through the snow bridge and came to a rest about 40 feet below the glacier surface, pretty tightly embedded in the ice.
Galtieri says other climbers saw Takak fall and started a rescue operation. The accident occurred at the mountain's 7,800-foot level of the Kahiltna Glacier along the West Buttress Route. Galtieri says more than two dozen people participated in the rescue, some taking turns lowering themselves into the crevasse to chip away at the ice.
After a lot of manual labor and final hour of some mechanical advantage in the end with a pneumatic chisel, they were able to free him from the ice and get him onward into medical care.
Galtieri says Takak was severely hypothermic and suffering from critical injuries when he was flown to Fairbanks Memorial Hospital.
I would have to say he has a tremendous will to survive, and it certainly was probably helped by the fact he knew right away that there was a team of people working to get him out.
Galtieri says it was the second major crevasse rescue operation to retrieve an unroped climber so far this spring on Denali.
This year, the lower glacier has had quite a bit of crevasse danger. Weaker snow bridges than usual, not a lot of winter snowpack.
The NPS cautions climbers to always travel roped together and to wear skis or snowshoes to increase flotation on soft or thin snowpack. The state and an Alaska Native Regional Corporation hope to finalize a settlement later this summer in a long-running land access dispute. Attorneys for the state and Otna Incorporated, in a court filing last week, say they hope to finalize a settlement within 90 days. Part of that time would be used for public comment. The dispute centers on access along a road leading from Copper Center to Klutina Lake. Otna has said the road traverses undeveloped Otna land. Last year, a Superior Court judge handed Otna a partial victory, saying the state's right-of-way claims were too far-reaching. Attorney General Jana Lindemuth has said the public will have a chance to comment once an agreement is reached, and the state will consider the comments in deciding its next steps. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, fire forecasting is tricky in Alaska, where the weather can change rapidly.
Really, it's the meteorological conditions over a relatively short period of time that drive the propensity for fires to start and spread.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The surviving passenger of a fatal plane crash near Haines in May told investigators that the pilot purposely stopped one engine to demonstrate how to restart it in flight. That's one detail in a preliminary report released by the National Transportation Safety Board this week. KHNS's Emily Files has more on the crash that killed two people and injured another.
David Kanat and Chan Valentine of Juneau and Stanley Kwok Wen of California were flying from Juneau to Haines on Saturday, May 27th. NTSB Alaska Chief Clint Johnson says the trio were taking Kanat's twin-engine Piper PA-30 to the Haines Beer Fest. But at about 11 a.m., about 10 miles away from Haines, something went wrong. The plane went down on a rocky beach near the Glacier Point airstrip. The pilot, Kanat, and Wen, the front seat passenger, were killed. Valentine was sitting in the back of the plane, and he survived, but sustained serious injuries. Johnson says an NTSB investigator interviewed Valentine in the hospital. During that interview, they learned this important detail.
Unfortunately, it does sound like the one engine, the right engine, was shut down intentionally, and they were unable to restart it, which ultimately led to the accident.
The NTSB's preliminary report summarizes Valentine's account that about 20 minutes into the flight, Kanat intentionally shut down the right engine to demonstrate how to restart it in flight. But it didn't work.
It's my understanding that they tried to restart it using the battery power, but they were unable to restart the right engine using battery. They then tried to air start it, which means at that point what they did is they climbed to an altitude and dove the airplane to try and get the airspeed up to be able to windmill the prop. Unfortunately, that did not work as well.
The NTSB report says that after multiple failed attempts to restart the engine, Kanat decided to land at the Glacier Point gravel airstrip. Valentine told the NTSB that Kanat wanted to land the plane and use a battery booster to start the right engine. Before landing, Valentine said Kanat made a low-level pass to check the conditions at the airstrip. That was Valentine's last memory of the flight. A witness across the Lynn Canal was watching the plane through binoculars. The NTSB report says the witness saw the plane reach the end of the airstrip, descend, turn right, and then crash into the beach. The witness said the plane hit the shore at a right wing down, nose down angle. The NTSB recovered the wrecked plane and says the damage is consistent with that angle of impact. The Chilkat Valley News reported that the witness, Steve Dice of Yakutat, and his friends helped save Valentine's life. After Dice saw the plane go down, he and Haines residents Tom, Patricia, and Kirby Faverty took a boat from their cabin to the crash site. They saw Valentine was alive but trapped in the plane. They ultimately were able to keep the plane from going under the rising water by attaching it to a backhoe from a nearby tourism camp. The NTSB report confirms that Dice and the Favertys kept the plane in shallow water until emergency responders arrived. Valentine was eventually taken to Harborview Medical Center in Seattle. A spokesperson there said the crash survivor is in satisfactory condition. There are still a lot of unanswered questions. Johnson with the NTSB says he does not know why pilot Kanat would try to demonstrate an in-air engine restart. And there's still the question of why the engine wouldn't restart after it was turned off.
At this point right now, investigators are going to be working very closely with the manufacturer, the airframe manufacturer, engine manufacturer, looking at performance issues, trying to figure out a little bit more of why they weren't able to restart the engine.
The NTSB will also conduct a more in-depth interview with Valentine once his health is better. Johnson says it will take 9 months to a year to compile the final report, which will include a probable cause. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Colorado State University is conducting a survey of Alaska residents to measure their attitudes toward wildlife. It's part of a nationwide study that began in 2005. Mark Birch is a wildlife biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He says Alaska residents' views differ from those of people who live in other states.
As you might expect, in Alaska, people do tend to be a little more utilitarian. In other words, they utilize wildlife for food and clothing and that way a little more than, say, people in some of the more urban areas that may perceive wildlife differently.
The survey hopes to measure not only attitudes but trends over time. Birch says the survey will help the ADF&G better meet public needs.
And in Alaska, we're looking at some of the barriers that people face as they pursue hunting as well. It's one of the specific interests that we're delving into a little bit deeper.
Researchers hope for a sample size of at least 1,000 Alaska residents.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
225 teachers received layoff notices this year from the Anchorage School District. And until lawmakers in Juneau settle on education funding levels for the coming school year, those educators remain in limbo. Alaska Public Media's Josh Edge caught up with a pair of teachers who work in the same classroom, one of whom received a pink slip and one who did not.
The Tuesday before school ended for the year was what's called a field day at Bowman Elementary School in Anchorage. Rosalind Worcester, a teacher for the school's first and second grade optional program, says it's packed with all sorts of outdoor activities, including, among many other things, a bounce house, giant Jenga, and something called the Sea Sponge Relay.
It was a beautiful day of just fun and dancing with our kids and being out in the sunshine and eating popsicles. It was magical. And then at the very end of the day, right after we took our kids out to the bus and just riding this amazing high to the end of the year, the principal let me know that we had received 3 pink slips at our school.
Rosalind, who just wrapped up her second year with the district, was one of 3 teachers at Bowman who received a pink slip that day. She splits the responsibility of educating a class of 44 first and second graders with her teaching partner, Shoshana Keegan. Shoshana just wrapped up her third year with ASD and was spared a layoff notice. When Rosalind broke the news to her, Shoshana says neither of them knew how to process what had just happened.
We just sat there. We're kind of like one, we were both new teachers, so we'd never been a part of this. We didn't really know exactly what pink slip meant. We didn't know the process. We didn't quite fully grasp everything that goes along with it. And then, two, it's just like you're kind of in this weird moment when you're like, what happens next?
This was their first year teaching together, and according to Shoshana, they've spent a lot of time together over the past year.
Roz and I call each other Teacher Bae because we spend more time with each other than our significant others most of the time.
The pair says they spent a lot of extra hours in the classroom during the first part of the school year, configuring their room, finalizing lesson plans, and everything in between. It's those extra hours and the close relationship between teachers that help cultivate an environment where students can excel. Shoshana says when teachers leave the district or are laid off, it not only sets class planning back, but it also makes developing and maintaining relationships with students and their parents difficult.
Most parents have, you know, more than one kid, and so they kind of filter through your classroom, and you'll have them, you know, one family for like 7 years potentially. And so you really get to know those parents, and they're so supportive and so loving, and it's like, I don't know, like not our little classroom we've built, is a little family, but then we've got that extended family of their parents.
For Rosalyn, there's more than her job at stake. She's also working on her master's degree. Her final project is creating interdisciplinary units to teach in multi-age classrooms, specifically for the ones she worked in this past school year.
I'm working on creating those to apply in our classroom and then gauge their impact and their efficacy. And if I end up switching schools and grade levels, I don't know how I can finish my master's project without having to redo several, completely change the project.
Regardless of the outcome, Rosalyn says she and Shoshana are committed to their students. On the last day of school, the pair sent each student home with two stamped envelopes, one with Shoshana's address, the other with Rosalyn's, and a note asking the students to write them this summer.
Send us a picture, send us a postcard, send us a drawing, send us a letter, send us a story, and we'll write you back. And, I mean, we stand by that, and we signed it forever your teachers. Rosalyn and Shoshana.
And Rosalyn says the sooner a budget is passed, the sooner those who have been laid off can make decisions to move forward, both professionally and personally. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
A scientist predicts climate change could have far-reaching effects on berry production on Kodiak Island. Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge wildlife biologist Bill Pyle just wrapped up a 2-year pilot study on the island. The study helps cement the monitoring method scientists will use to study berry growth, including time-lapse cameras. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
Salmon berries may be limited or non-existent this year. Pyle says winter conditions play a part. This year was unusually dry, and there was little snowpack to insulate the plants. He says the temperature from November through March for the last 2 years was 6 degrees above normal. This year, Kodiak was 1.5 degrees below normal.
We really don't know when the problem started and whether it was a long-term situation this winter, but the bottom line is that it appears that salmonberry and blueberry were affected by the amount of cold and the depth of cold that we had that killed the winter buds and killed the above-ground stems of those plants.
Elderberries fared better. Pyle says cold temperatures didn't hack away at them. It was the Sitka black-tailed deer.
You have the deer stripping the bark, which that girdling action kills the above-ground growth. Fortunately for the species that we're looking at, they all are very vigorous resprouters. They regrow from the base of the plant, and so it's not like the plants were outright killed.
Pyle says this year saw a deer die-off later in winter, January through March. He says while the spruce forests offer some protection for the introduced species, Kodiak's more exposed terrain could have contributed to the deaths. And he says throughout that time, the deer were surviving off elderberries.
It really has a lot to do with the fat that they bring into the winter and determines how long they can last in conjunction with how cold it gets. It's cold enough. And they probably had a good year last year with fat supplies, but it was enough to really knock them out. I mean, the elderberry just wasn't enough to do it for them and to facilitate the survival of most of those deer.
Pyle says if the deer continue to munch on elderberries year after year, they could kill off the entire plant species. He says normally, every 3 to 8 years, a harsh Kodiak winter would sweep through the deer population and keep it at bay. Without that, they're free to continue eating the elderberries and other species that bears also survive on, like blueberries. He says because this winter was so dry and lacked significant snowpack, deer had easier access to the areas where those berries grow. In the short term, it looks like the lack of berries over the summer may not bode well for brown bears. Pyle says a mixture of food sources like berries and meat help maintain the bear's nutritional balance. Throwing off that balance means that more bears may look to human activity for a food source.
If they encounter a person with, say, they've got a deer down and, you know, there's going to be more circumstances where the bears pursue that shot animal. And once the bear has accessed human food, say it's in a town situation, then usually that's what they'll continue to seek and usually end up in trouble because of that.
Bears that develop a reliance on scavenging human trash have a tendency to return to town again and again. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
Wildfire season is off to a slow start in Alaska, but that could change very quickly because predicting how severe a wildfire season will be in the state is tricky. Alaska Energy Desk is checking in with climatologist Brian Brettschneider each week as part of the segment Ask a Climatologist. He told editor Annie Feit that over the entire season, which runs through the end of July, no wildfire forecast is useful for Alaska.
Because conditions that promote fire really are highly dependent on just a few days of meteorological conditions. So if temperatures are warm, that gives you low relative humidity. If there's a breeze, you know, that literally can fan fires. And then you need an ignition source, which can be either human ignition or most commonly lightning. And so those are things that more than a few days out are really hard to forecast, which is different than, say, in the lower 48, where long-term drought, the curing of grasses, those kind of things you can see and you can forecast weeks and even months in advance. You can track them over long periods of time. Here in Alaska, we don't really have drought conditions per se. So it really is the meteorological conditions over a relatively short period of time that drive the propensity for fires to start and spread.
So things can kind of switch in an instant.
It really can. You can have wet after wet, cloudy, cool, and then just a week of warm, windy, dry, and then throw in some lightning strikes, and you know the whole state could erupt, figuratively speaking.
And lightning is really the key there for most fires in Alaska?
It is. I mean, if you look at the stats in terms of acreage burned, it's by far lightning caused, and so pretty reliably kicks in the first half of June. And so once it does, then that's when we're going to see the fire acreage expand. But the lightning season, so far, it really hasn't kicked in yet, but it will. It always does. And then the question is, you know, how many of those will ignite new fires? But once we hit into June in the high sun season in interior Alaska, you get near continuous daylight. You get solar heating for most of the day. And so you end up with lower pressure, warm temperatures, and that promotes what's called a thermal trough, and that helps facilitate storm development, lightning strikes, and it's that high sun season is really where things get kicked in.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Emily Files in Haines, Allison Mollenkamp in Dillingham, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, and Josh Edge and Annie Feit in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our producer and editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
If you're one of the 120,000 Alaskans with some college but no degree, the Finnish College Alaska Initiative at the University of Alaska Southeast offers a degree program with flexible online learning and a personalized degree plan. UAS is now offering a 3-credit tuition waiver for eligible applicants. Apply for the fall semester by Tuesday, August 1st. Learn more at finnishcollege.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.